is Friday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into the background of a Florida man who's a suspected killer of 17 people in a school earlier this week. World security officials gather in Munich, Germany, and country music fans mourn the loss of singer Daryl Singletary. It's all ahead. The troubled 19-year-old man accused of the killing of 17 people at a Florida school is being held without bond. Nicholas Cruz appeared briefly at a court hearing Thursday to hear the formal charges of 17 counts of premeditated murder. His court appearance came hours after President Donald Trump gave a brief address about the tragedy. VOA's justice correspondent Masood Forivar is following the Florida case, and he tells me what the FBI knew about Cruz before the deadly shooting.
Well, the FBI hasn't said publicly how much they know about him, but they certainly appear to know a lot more about Nicholas Cruz today than they did when he first crossed their radar back in September. We know that on September 24th of 2017, a YouTube blogger in Mississippi alerted the FBI about a comment that someone by the name of Nicholas Cruz had left on one of his videos saying, "I want to be a professional school shooter." Now, this video blogger by the name of Ben Benite that I've spoken to a couple of times confirmed the account. And he said that he was visited by two FBI agents the next day, but didn't hear back from them until right after the shooting, when they called him again to follow up. I mean, what the FBI has said publicly about how they handled the initial tip they received in September was that they ran it through their internal databases, and it came up empty. They made a record of this incident, but didn't appear to have more information to go on.
There have been reports that Cruz had some links to white supremacist groups.
That's true, but there's yesterday the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, reported that Nicholas Cruz was a member of a white supremacist, white nationalist group in Florida by the name of Republic of Florida. ADL interviewed this organization and had it confirmed that he had been a member. We don't know how long he had been a member and what his association was like, but this organization has confirmed that he was a member of the Republic of Florida.
There also are a number of reports saying he had a very troubled family background. I mean, he was adopted, and both his adopted parents have died, and that apparently his mother had struggled with him a lot. And there were reports that the other kids in school that knew him thought that he was strange or he was difficult. Is that what you understand?
That is my understanding. I think his fellow students, teachers, and even local law enforcement authorities knew a lot more about him at the time or for the past few months than the FBI did. And that, you know, about his behavior, mental illness, threats that he made to fellow students that eventually led the school to expel him. So, you know, his background, his temperament, and his behavior, it was well known and alarming enough to local school authorities to decide to expel him.
You know, there have been reports that there are new copycat threats have emerged. You know, people have heard about this case and they're threatening to do something similar, like shoot up a school. I'm sure authorities are concerned about that.
That's been a longstanding concern for law enforcement all along. Not only about school shootings, but other incidents, even terrorist attacks in this country. But in terms of school shootings and mass shootings in recent years, four of the deadliest mass shootings since 2012 have involved the use of AR-15, the civilian version of the M16 automatic rifle. And that, according to experts, is a copycat use. Now, they say that a lot of these mass shooters have used the AR-15, not so much because they're powerful and easy to purchase, but because these shooters knew that they were effectively used by others in the past. But copycatting doesn't explain the whole story. Mental illness, ease of access to guns, and other factors are also cited as contributors to these types of incidents that, unfortunately, we are seeing in increasing frequency.
VOA's justice correspondent, Masood Farivar. Here are some of the top stories that are trending. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson discusses issues of mutual interest with top Turkish officials. A massive fraud at an Indian state-owned bank is linked to a celebrity jeweler. The Afghan Taliban's open letter to the American people calls for dialogue. And former U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney announces he will run for the Senate seat in Utah. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2012, NASA astronomers predicted that our Milky Way galaxy will collide with its neighboring Andromeda galaxy in about 4 billion years. Scientists said that when this galactic collision takes place, Andromeda, believed to be 2 to 3 times the size of the Milky Way, will completely engulf our own galaxy. Now, an international team of researchers finds that both galaxies are about the same size. Past studies have determined the Milky Way has a mass of 750 billion times that of our Sun. Using a new scientific technique, the researchers have determined that the Andromeda galaxy is about 800 billion times more massive than our Sun. Researchers say that in light of their new findings that both galaxies are nearly equal in mass, new simulations are needed to determine what will happen when Andromeda and the Milky Way do collide. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the U.S. Postal Service marks the Lunar New Year with a stamp designed by a New York City immigrant artist. World leaders and security officials have gathered in Munich for the yearly security conference. Tensions between Russia and Western nations, concern about North Korea's nuclear program, and the Syrian conflict are causing scrutiny at the gathering. Reporter Henry Ridgewell is in Munich, and he tells me from the conference about some of the key areas of focus.
Well, the rather bleak backdrop that was introduced by the organizers of this conference was what they called the erosion of the pillars that sustain the international world order. Behind that purported unwillingness of the United States to fulfill the role that it has done in the past in upholding the rule of law and those global institutions worldwide. And that has left many question marks over the future of global security. The organizer here, Wolfgang Ischinger, with a warning that we are closer now to a major conflict between world powers than we have been for decades. So it is against that bleak backdrop that political and military leaders from across the world gather here in Munich. Some of the arenas that they are looking at, they are focusing on, include, of course, Syria, where there are warnings that two NATO members, the United States and Turkey, may increasingly look like they're facing off against each other over the Kurdish-held areas in that country. We're about to hear from the president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, for an update on the conflict there, and the prospect of a UN peacekeeping force in eastern Ukraine will be raised here at the conference. Russia's President Putin isn't attending, but his Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov is, so we hope to hear from the Moscow view on that conflict as well. But if you take all of those arenas together with North Korea as well, of course, and the brinkmanship over its nuclear bomb program, then that adds up to a great deal of global threats that the leaders here will be discussing over the course of the 3 days.
And I believe there are some concerns as well about the future of the European Union and military integration.
That's right. We've heard from the German and French defense ministers today, and both of them outlined their vision for cooperation in Europe over defense. Of course, so far, European defense has been centered around NATO, but there are calls now for a European army of sorts. There's a European Defense Fund. There's this so-called PESCO cooperation on defense in Europe. And if that is the path that European Union members will take, there are concerns within NATO over how that will mesh and integrate with the NATO structures. And we heard some quite strong words from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg this afternoon on his concerns that any EU structures may exclude non-EU members, even though most of the defence spending comes from those non-EU members. So, for example, after Britain leaves the European Union, some 80% of defence spending within NATO will come from non-European Union countries. And so there are many concerns over that, but also there is some praise for Europe's efforts within NATO circles as well for taking more initiative over their own defence, for becoming more self-reliant. And I think that follows what has been happening in the United States. Of course, with President Trump in power for just over a year now, on the campaign trail, he insisted that NATO allies would have to spend more on defense. And I think what we're seeing here is NATO allies answering that call, realizing that the United States is serious in its demands. And this is Europe coming up with its answers. It will take a lot of organization and a lot of cooperation between 28 different member states of the European Union, really, to make anything happen soon, but it seems like that is the path that the EU has chosen.
Henry Ridgewell reporting from Munich. Well, on a lighter note, the United States Postal Service is marking the Chinese New Year Friday with a new Lunar New Year Forever stamp, which was dedicated last month in Hawaii. The Year of the Dog stamp was designed by Chinese-American artist Cam Mack, and it highlights cultural traditions of the holiday. Heidi Chang reports from Honolulu.
As lion dancers entertained the crowd, the U.S. Postal Service unveiled the Year of the Dog stamp in Honolulu. The design by New York-based artist Cam Mack depicts three stalks of lucky bamboo.
In Chinese tradition, three lucky bamboo symbolize first, bless and luck. Second is long life. Third is wealth. I also include the pasting of the folk characters, and that means blessing and luck.
The late Hawaii artist Clarence Lee designed the first series of Lunar New Year stamps, which featured the animals in the Chinese zodiac. In 2008, Cam Mack began designing the second series, which highlights some of the holiday's customs and traditions that have endured throughout time. The Year of the Dog stamp also includes Lee's original paper-cut dog in the upper left corner. The Postal Service issued the first Lunar New Year stamp in 1992. Among the stamps Mack has designed, his favorite is the one for 2010, the Year of the Tiger. It features narcissus flowers.
It was something that my grandmother would cultivate right before the Lunar New Year. And as a little boy, I always watched her doing it. And the fragrance from that flower always remind me Lunar New Year is coming. And always bring back really fond memory, you know, being with my grandma.
Mack's family immigrated from Hong Kong to America in 1971 when he was 10 years old. His parents worked long hours and low-paying jobs to support the family, his father as a dishwasher in a Chinese restaurant, and his mother in a Chinatown sweatshop. Mack struggled to learn English, growing up at a time when Chinese gangs were rampant in New York City's Chinatown. Fortunately, Mack got involved with a city art workshop, which encouraged inner-city youth to explore the arts. That's when he discovered his passion. Now in his 50s, Mack lives in Brooklyn and teaches painting at New York's Fashion Institute of Technology. He also has illustrated numerous books and authored his own picture book called My Chinatown, 1 Year in Poems. Through an organization called Behind the Book, Mack helps mentor young people and shares what it was like growing up in Chinatown.
A lot of these kids are mostly Latinos and African-American kids in inner city. I had lectured in Brooklyn and in Harlem. And so besides reading them the books, I actually, you know, take them out to Chinatown and have them experience all the things that I experienced growing up. I think it's fascinating for these kids because everything they saw was all new to them. So I just want to stir their imaginations and want them to really learn about other cultures besides what they only know in their own neighborhood.
Whenever he's speaking at community events, Cam Mack says he hopes to inspire people to be proud of who they are and not feel ashamed if they're different. He recalled what happened when he spoke at a public school in Chinatown.
And so after my presentation to these group of kids, and a bunch of Chinese kids came to me very emotional way, "Cam, I'm so happy there's a book that is about me." I say, "Yes, this book is about all of our experiences, our similar experiences." So, and at that moment, I felt really emotional because, wow, the book itself had moved other kids, and they will not feel that they are isolated, that there's actually a book that actually play a very positive light about how they grew up, and there's something that they can relate to. And so I think that's a very positive thing.
For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. This week, one of country music's finest unexpectedly passed away. Daryl Singletary died in his home in Tennessee Monday, February 12th. He was 46 years old. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins me to talk of his legacy. So, Nikki, tell us about Daryl Singletary. What made him so special?
Well, in addition to his voice that people loved, Daryl was one of the great defenders of traditional country music. He has an interesting story. He was born in Cairo, Georgia, and then he moved to Nashville in 1990. He got a gig as a demo singer. He did the demo for the song Old Pair of Shoes, which caught the ear of Randy Travis. Randy Travis eventually recorded that song, but it's kicked off their relationship. And through Randy's management company, Daryl got signed to Giant Records. And then in 1995, he released his self-titled project, which was also co-produced by Randy Travis. And it yielded the hit Too Much Fun. More hits followed, like I Let Her Lie and Amen Kind of Love and The Note. However, as the country radio landscape changed and traditional country music was pushed to the background and became more marginalized, and pop country and bro country took more center stage, there was an opportunity, you know, for many artists to say, okay, am I going to pivot my sound, you know, and continue with my career, the trajectory of my career? Well, instead of going with the flow, so to speak, Daryl decided to stay true to the traditional sounds that he loved. And a lot of people loved him all the more for that. His concerts remained packed. He continued to put out music, including his 2015 release, There's Still a Little Country Left, and the duet album with Rhonda Vincent, American Grandstand, which was released in 2017. He rightly believed there was an audience for traditional country music, and he catered to it because traditional country music was him, and it was important to him to remain true to himself.
He and Randy Travis, you said they had a special relationship.
They did. They did. They worked together. You know, he was a mentor as well as a friend. And upon the news of his passing, Randy Travis stated, he said, "I love Daryl Singletary's heart and soul for life, for others, and for true country music. Co-producing his first LP was a highlight in my career. He was one of the best and made me a better artist." That's a pretty hefty thing to say, coming from an icon. And other artists chimed in. Charlie Daniels, another icon. He said, Daryl sang country music the way it should be sung. Travis Tritt, he chimed in. He said he was a true country voice and his talent will be sorely missed. But new artists also chimed in and paid their respects as well. Jake Owen, for example, he said, Daryl was the voice we wish we all had. I was lucky enough to have seen him sing live many times, and I'm absolutely heartbroken to learn of his passing. Luke Combs, who was like the breakout star of like 2017 and even this year, he said that Daryl was the single greatest country voice of our generation. He said, what a huge loss today. This one hurts. And in general, new artists stand on the shoulders of those who've gone before them. So technically, they stand on the shoulders of traditional country artists, even if their music decides to take a different turn. And Daryl, you know, also stood on those shoulders, but he maintained those traditions. So he didn't just stand on their shoulders. He lifted them up in his work, even when it was commercially unpopular. And he will always be appreciated and celebrated for doing so. He said in his own words, he said, I think if you do something outside the realm of what's in your heart, you're compromising that integrity. And on that note, I think it's fair to say, and many would agree with me, that Daryl indeed was no fake. He was the real thing.
Wonderful tributes. You can hear music from Daryl Singletary on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and on Twitter at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
She'd come home 6 a.m. Tell me she'd been out with friends, and I let her lie. I let her lie.
Well, the music of Daryl Singletary closes our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply troubled that a Vietnamese court has convicted and sentenced peaceful labor and environmental activist Hoang Duc Binh and Nguyen Nam Phong to 14 years and 2 years in prison, respectively. Both men were charged under the criminal code for taking part in protests and advocacy in relation to the massive marine disaster caused by the Taiwanese steel company Formosa along the central coast of Vietnam in April 2016. Hoang Duc Binh has repeatedly voiced support for Vietnamese political prisoners and detainees. He has also participated in several of the Formosa protests and helped organize groups advocating compensation for fishermen who lost their livelihoods due to the toxic spill. Under Article 258 of the Penal Code, Hoang Duc Binh was charged with abusing freedom and democracy to infringe upon the interests of the state, the legitimate interest and rights of organization and citizen. Human Rights Watch Asia Director Brad Adams said, "The sad irony here is that Vietnam is charging a human rights defender with abusing freedom, democracy, and rights, when the truth is that the people of Vietnam have no freedom, democracy, or rights." Mr. Binh and Mr. Phong's convictions are the sixth such verdicts in recent days of individuals peacefully expressing their views. They are among many individuals convicted this past year for exercising basic rights, including Nguyen Ngoc Nu Quyen, also known as Mother Mushroom, and Tran Thi Nga. The trend of increased arrests, convictions, and harsh sentences of peaceful activists since early 2016 is very concerning, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. All people, she stressed, have the right to fundamental freedoms of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. The United States calls on Vietnam to release all prisoners of conscience immediately and to allow all individuals in Vietnam to express their views freely and assemble peacefully without fear of retribution. Spokesperson Nauert also urged the Vietnamese government to ensure its actions and laws, including the penal code, are consistent with the human rights provisions of Vietnam's constitution and its international obligations and commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.